Welcome to Establishing Shots, the podcast about the art, craft, and business of filmmaking. I'm Nick Hilton. My guest this week is Yann Demange, director of 2014-71 and now White Boy Rick. Thanks as ever to our partners at CineView for facilitating this, and head on over there, cine-view.com, for lots of great reviews and features and things like a five-star review of Assassination Nation, which, you know, Christopher Matchell will try and defend. Here's the interview. So I'm here with Yann Demange, the director of White Boy Rick, a new true story based on the life of Rick Vershey Jr., is that it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Who becomes a sort of, well, he's described as a drugs kingpin, but he becomes a sort of player, maybe, would be more accurate, in the drugs industry.
I think that's just the way it's being sold. Really, it's a father and son story.
Yeah.
And set in the backdrop of poverty in the 80s in Detroit during the crack epidemic. And yeah, the kid, he did indeed get sucked into the drug trade. And what's most fascinating, he's like the youngest informant ever, FBI informant ever. He's an FBI informant at the age of 14. But, you know, the central narrative is a father and son story that runs all the way through it.
It is also, I think it's fair to say, a crime film. I mean, it's genre hot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you've got Matthew McConaughey as the father figure. I mean, it's another great Matthew McConaughey performance in terms of this new kind of way low lives that he's plays
very moving in it.
So you see that. I can see that you instinctively want to focus in on that father-son relationship as the heart of the film. Can you tell me a little bit about how you developed that in a film where there are so many other strands that you could be pulled towards as a viewer?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a balancing act. You know, I don't really know how successful I was balancing it right now, but I don't have the distance. But when the reason, what drew me to make the film and what resonated with me personally was the father-son story and the narrative about the family. But once I took that on, I had a drug dealer story to tell, an informant story to tell. I had these other strands, and you just wanted to haiku it, really, just like to try and get the bit, because it's a true story. You have a sort of moral obligation to explain some of the facts, so you understand, and events, and you kind of want to deliver a little bit on the informant narrative. But the genre, the film for me at its heart that I really wanted to tell was the family story, you know, and try and get a tone that wasn't earnest or worthy, but captured the tone of the guy I met in jail, you know, who's very fucking funny. He's a very funny guy. And his banter and his whole attitude was infectious and quite unique. He's trying to capture that voice. But it was a balancing act. It was tough because it is multi-stranded. And as you say, it's kind of genre blending in a way. You know, it hops genres.
So that central character, we've got to talk about Richie Merritt as White Boy Rick. Although, of course, his father could also be White Boy Rick. It sort of, I guess, it, you know, speaks to their dynasties, like the David
Senior
Attenborough.
Senior and Junior.
Yeah.
Like the Attenborough. I can't believe he just did that. Like it.
So, Richie Merritt, and I see, it's something you're probably sick of talking about, how you found Richie Merritt outside a principal's office in Baltimore. But
I didn't find him. Let's just be clear. I don't go out scouting myself. I can't claim that one. One of the casting directors, there are two casting directors. There's Francine Maisler, who's incredible, and she took care of the main cast. And we hired someone called Jennifer Vendetti to do some of the street casting. She did American Honey, for instance. And she sent scouts out to many states, different states, looking in impoverished areas where there was racial mixing in the schools, because as we know, America's pretty segregated. And it's finding somewhere where there was genuine crossover in the schools, and we could possibly find someone that, you know, that was living a very similar life to Rick. At the same time as us on the side reading actors, real actors from all over the place. It wasn't like I wasn't intransigent and going, it has to be a street cast role. Like it was a two-pronged attack, and I was looking at actors too. But one of the scouts went to this school in Baltimore, was pitching the principal, and as they walked out of the office, there was this kid waiting because he was in trouble. And the principal goes, well, you can start with this kid here. And he's the one that's in the movie.
And that, obviously, I've seen interviews with him, and he speaks very much like the character in the film. He sort of carries himself like the character in the film. Did you feel like that was something you wanted for authenticity, or did it actually in a way make it harder because, you know, how do you work on a professional set with, you know, someone who is so raw?
Well, I mean, I've had quite a lot of experience working with people that are raw, if you like, with 71 and with Top Boy. I did a lot of street casting and non-actors, and I've done it throughout my career actually. But you know, there are the pros and cons. Like he brings undoubtedly a sense of authenticity. He is authentically from that world. There's no denying that. And at times, he'd inform how the scene should play, and he'd take the Hollywood out of it, and like he'd have an effect on Matthew's performance because Matthew couldn't go off on one. He'd have to be. He was anchored by the kid, and he had to constantly be cognizant of being in the same film as the kid. So if you like, it had an interesting effect on Matthew's performance. But there are times where, you know, the kid had never acted before, and, you know, he'd following the shape of a scene or the shape of a performance, you know, crafting that with him is a different challenge, because he's never acted before, and he doesn't have the vocabulary or the know-how to talk about what a scene should do and it should deliver. So we spent some time workshopping with him, and we just did some work with him, you know, and it is what you saw now. But it was challenging at times, absolutely, but not in terms of professionalism and him being on set. If anything, he sucked it up more than somebody that would be that's old hat at it.
It's a great cast, I think, beyond, you know, the McConaughey headline. I mean, you've got Belle Powley and Eddie Marzan in there. I want to talk just very briefly about being a sort of British director going to America and taking these British actors over with you. Do you feel like you wanted to give a sort of British flavour to the crew and the cast, or was that sort of involuntary, just the people you knew?
I mean, look, it's involuntary. It's not like an agenda. But I travel with my DOP, which I've been working with for 13 years, Tat Radcliffe from London, and my editor, Chris Wyatt from London as well. So I'm always going to bring that flavour to whatever thing I do. I didn't cast them because they were Brits. I just cast them because I thought they were the best for the role. I didn't know Belle Powley was British when I saw Diary of a Teenage Girl, to be honest with you. So I only found that out afterwards. So I was saying, what about the girl in Diary of a Teenage Girl? What about her? I didn't know she was British at that point. So, no, there's no agenda. But it's nice when they come over. Eddie I've worked with before on Criminal Justice years ago. I love him. I'm a big fan. I'd put him in anything I do.
Yeah, there's a bit where he dancing in the club, and it's just, I could watch that for an hour. But you, this is your kind of first movie where you've gone to America, and you presumably had your kind of choice of projects to an extent after 71.
To an extent. I was fortunate. I had options and opportunities. I didn't take any of them. I decided to develop this.
And how different is the process, you know, from the
British? It's too much to put it. It's such a long question to answer, but it's not that different. And then it's utterly different at the same time. It's in terms of how they approach shooting. It's really methodology and process. But ultimately, you know, storytelling and filmmaking is filmmaking, and you can slot into it. And now I've got enormous respect for the American crews, and I learned a lot from the experience. Now I know what to expect. You know, it was like a huge learning curve. I guess my answer is a bit nebulous, but to unravel it and to talk about specifics would take too long. You know, I worked in TV in the UK for a long time. It's not a million miles away. It's not that much different.
Do you think the step up from TV to feature films and the step up from 71 to White Boy Rick is a sort of similar jump, or do you, in terms of the experience you need to bring to the project?
I mean, they're different. It's very different jumps, very different jumps. The sort of stuff that you need to juggle and balance behind the camera is completely different. You know, there's a whole culture that's completely different. But the filmmaking remains the same, and that's the thing you have to home in on at the end of the day. It's working with actors, it's telling stories and trying to elicit an emotional response. That's the craft of storytelling remains the same, and that's what anchors the whole thing. So it's not completely alien. It just comes with different baggage.
Can we talk just briefly about the production design? Because I thought 71, for instance, looks... I mean, I saw 71 when it came out. I think I rented it at Blockbuster. That's how long ago it feels in my head. And it looks brilliant. You know, you crafted that Belfast, people beating tin cans against the floor, the riot scenes. And here again, the whole film looks fantastic. And it looks like 80s Detroit. Now, I know it was filmed in, not Detroit. I've blanked on where it was filmed.
It's Cleveland. Some of it's in Detroit. Okay. Cleveland. Yep.
And to what extent could you film on location? To what extent has kind of it been like a time capsule sense in certain areas of Cleveland and Detroit?
What do you mean?
How much did you have to build the? You know, obviously they live in an area that is quite deprived. Yeah. You've got a lot of the gang culture areas, the skate rinks, which are very of a time.
How much of it did we need to create?
How much could you film? There's a big debate on, I guess, in Detroit at the moment about the extent to which, after General Motors and all the layoffs there, that the city has kind of been held in stasis. You know, was there a sense that you could sort of just drop yourself into that environment and?
Well, no, you took. I see what you mean now. No, you can't just turn up at Detroit and shoot it and it's ready to go for 80s Detroit. Detroit as it is now would need a lot more work in terms of production design to make it look like it did in the 80s. You know, it's almost post-apocalyptic now. You know, there's grass growing, weeds and grass growing through the sidewalk, and there's houses missing, and it's like. It's actually happening, having a little bit of an upturn now, and a lot of artists buying homes there. But Cleveland, East Side Cleveland, is a good ringer for 80s Detroit mm-hmm. in terms of architecture. And then we had to bring that sort of production design where you make it look more derelict, and every location, every interior we filmed in, there was production design involved in aging it down and making it rough and making it feel right. There was a lot of work involved. The skate land didn't exist as it's portrayed. There wasn't one in Cleveland. Ironically, the one he actually used to go to in Detroit is still standing. And it's a great location. And I used that as the basis for designing the place that he went to in Cleveland. But all those lights and everything, there's a lot of production, a lot of work went into it, as it did with 71, you know. I really care about production design. And, and we tried to get a sense that it was 360 and you could tell the story from the inside. And it was like a real, you're sort of passing through a world that exists.
Yeah, I think from what I know, it feels like one of your hallmarks is this production design that feels meticulous. And I've heard you talking in other interviews about the camera work and the extent to which, you know, that idea of you want to be able to do what you can, you know, whatever you can, you want to be limited by the environment. Just to go back to 71, you know, obviously that was made with the support of Film 4 and BFI. How healthy do you think the funding opportunities for young British filmmakers are at the moment?
I've not been in the UK for the last 4 years. So I'm not the right person to talk about the state of it right now and how it stands. All I can say is, like, when I had my opportunity to make my first film, I'm just absolutely eternally grateful that we have public funding, that we have an institution like the BFI. I would not be here now if it wasn't for them, because the Film Council prior to that supported me, engaged me, financially supported me at times with some ideas that I had and developing. They believed in me and they gave me an opportunity to come through. I think in the UK, we developed such amazing raw talent. Look at a film like Beast. I'm on the BIFFA this year, one of the jury, and I'm looking at the British films and I'm like, such exciting films are getting made that would never get made in the States, where it's just about, you know, whether it's commercial product. So I think that side of it is amazing, but the talent gets plucked straight away and taken by the States in a way. But I think that, you know, we're very lucky to have Film 4, we're very lucky to have the BBC Films, you know, the Film Council, the BFI. I think it's an incredible thing, and I hope it thrives, and I hope they continue to you know, you look at I'm Not a Witch, you sort of think, well, this is amazing, like they're pushing diversity in film and find more diverse UK filmmakers, and we have to do that, and without public funding I don't think it will happen.
And you talked about there about kind of America plucking, which is a natural thing.
Plucking is the wrong word. I mean, it's like it's an industry there and there's more opportunities. There's you know, but I mean, there's a lot of UK talent that goes over there.
And you're now based there full time, I guess. Presumably you've got scripts on your table at the moment. I don't know if your next project is something you're committed to, but would you think about kind of coming back and doing another thing like 71 here? Or
100%. Yeah, I would 100%. I want nothing more. I always aspired to be a London filmmaker and make films in London. Those opportunities didn't arise, but I haven't given up on it. I want to make films in the UK. And I'm developing a couple of things to do here.
And do you feel like you're gaining ever more kind of freedom to do, you know, I've heard you talk about the way that 71 arrived on your desk, sort of dropped from heaven. And the same with White Boy Rick. Do you feel like now you're approaching things in a more direct way, a more personal way, or are you just still?
I try and make everything I do personal. You know, I absolutely, 71 is a very personal film. You know, all that's, I brought all that stuff between the two brothers at the front of the film, and the idea of a foster home that came from my childhood. I put that into the film, changed the ending with the writer. To a certain extent, White Boy Rick is probably, because it was a true story, it was the hardest one to put my personal stamp on it. But all the story, the family story, resonated with me personally. And the idea of the kid being an outsider and being tribeless is something personal. And actually, the same themes, if you like, are in 71, are in Top Boy too. So that's a very personal thing. I love being able to float around. If I can write my own destiny, I'll continue to hop around genres and tell stories about people that aren't ethnically or the background aren't the same as me. You know, it doesn't matter where they're from or what they are, or what their orientation is, as long as I can make a personal connection with it. But am I making something that's directly more personal? I am developing two projects that are very personal, and that'll be more, one of them might be more biographical. I'll smother it so you can't recognize it. But yeah, absolutely, I'm doing that as well.
Well, Jan, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you, man.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, and please leave us a review there if you've listened this far. If you've listened this far, you're clearly a huge fan. Please leave us a 5-star review and say some kind words, and it helps people find us. And you can also listen on Spotify, TuneIn, all those various places. And if you're interested in advertising on the podcast, drop me a line at nick@podopods, that's podotpods.com, and we can have a chat about that. Thanks for listening, and speak to you soon.